Welcome to the Israel Daily News Podcast. I'm your host, Shanna Fold, and I'm here to get you caught up quickly. I've got some top news stories for you today from Israel, and guess what? You're listening, so you're already on top of your game. Survive and thrive, people, and knowledge is the best weapon. Today is Thursday, May 14th, 2026 in the Gregorian calendar, and the 27th of Iyar, 5786 in the Hebrew calendar. Tomorrow is my Hebrew birthday, and it is also Yom Yerushalayim, or Jerusalem Day, the day where Israelis celebrate the recapture of Jerusalem, making it the capital of Israel. Today, however, we have some info on the successes of the war on Iran coming straight from the mouth of one of Israel's top defense professionals, the chairman of Rafael Advanced Defense Systems. Plus, stay tuned for the end of the show when we have a Torah thought for you by Rabbi Yossi Madvig of Oswego, New York. Now, let's get to the news. A leading Israeli expert on Iran shares that it took only 10 seconds to complete the strike that killed top Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps officials in the last round of war with Iran, and that includes the killing of top boss Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. The reason the strike lasted 10 seconds was because, as we learned in a private briefing on Monday, that if the strike had been so long as a short 10 minutes, heads of the IRGC would have already escaped to their bunkers and changed locations. We sat in on more than an hour of information from Dr. Yuval Steinitz, who serves as the chairman of the Rafael Advanced Defense Systems. This major state-owned firm is responsible for air defense systems like the Iron Dome, David Sling, and the latest technology that everyone wants, the Iron Beam Laser. Dr. Steinitz shares that in the second stage of Operation Roaring Lion, it took just 36 hours to gain air superiority. And he said that Russia could not gain air superiority during the course of four long years of fighting in Ukraine. And it took Israel less than 2 days. The night that Operation Roaring Lion commenced, some 200 F-15s and F-16 fighter jets flew over Syria, Jordan, Iraq, and other Gulf states and made it all the way into the heart of Iran to make this attack. And the enemy army did not see a thing until the first explosions took out the IRGC leadership. Now, where did we hear all of these juicy details? On Monday, the Israel Daily News was invited to attend a reception hosted by the Jerusalem Center for Security and Foreign Affairs, but they did their event right here in Tel Aviv, and the keynote speaker was Dr. Yuval Steinitz himself. He's a leading Israeli expert on Iran's nuclear and ballistic capabilities, which he says Israel was able to reduce by a lot during the last few wars, the last few operations within the last war that we've been in. Professor Steinitz serves as chairman of Rafael Defense Systems and is the former Israeli Minister of Finance, Intelligence, Strategic Affairs, and Energy. The event highlighted the removal of Iranian leadership and the ups and downs of engaging in war with Iran, first alone and then with the United States as a partner, and how Iran's leadership poses a strategic threat not just to the Middle East, but to the entire world. Dr. Steinitz spoke for more than an hour, and I personally was looking around at the other journalists, wondering how we were all going to pull out a cohesive story from this long and robust speech. Well, I was a little old school. I had my pad and my pen, and I jotted down the things that made my ears perk up, and I decided to cut the highlights for you and share the parts that I thought were the most impressive and the highlights that were really showcasing serious Israeli achievements from the last operations with Iran, which, by the way, I've been covering this region since 2018, and I never thought that I would see this day or be hearing things like what I just reported about Israel flying over Syria and Iraq to reach Iran. I mean, these are unprecedented times. Maybe I thought things would come to a head with Iran in 20 years from now, but things that we are seeing today, including regime change in Syria, Jordan working to help Israel, Gulf states turning its back on Iran and joining forces with Israel, even Lebanese and Israeli officials meeting in Washington to discuss working together. The Middle East is changed forever, and we are in unprecedented times. Let's have a listen to some of those unprecedented moments as told by Dr. Steinitz. He's a pretty big deal. He could barely get out of the hotel because guests who came to the program were trying to get a word with him. He's one of those people who somehow ended up in every major finance, security, and strategy conversation here in Israel in the last two decades.
First, I want to speak about the reason. The main reason for this war vis-a-vis Iran was the nuclear project. Of course, we would be delighted, and I think most of the free world, and all the more so the Iranian people themselves, would be delighted if this war would have been resulted with the collapse of this terrible, terrible, fanatic, barbaric Islamic regime of the Ayatollahs. I think most of the world would be happy, and of course, Israelis, Americans, and the Iranians themselves. But this was not the main purpose. Without the nuclear threat, we won't go to war. At least from Israeli perspective, we won't go to war in order to help the Iranian to get rid of this evil regime. I admit it. They gained nuclear weapons, and now they have an arsenal of weapons, the North Koreans, and they are intimidating Japan, they're intimidating, of course, South Korea, and even the United States of America, and actually also the rest of the world. But I think it should be clear, crystal clear, that we couldn't afford, the world couldn't afford, but of course the United States and Israel couldn't afford that this scenario will repeat itself in Iran. And unfortunately, they got closer and closer. They already enriched to 60%. By the way, there is no real gap between 20% and 60%. 20% is already close to weapon-grade uranium, but they move already to 60%. We notice that they resume also some research and some test, you know, and some thinking. I won't get into details that also will bring them closer and closer to the nuclear weapons. So it was the last 90 minutes or 89 minutes to react. And this was the main purpose, to push them back from nuclear weapons, because today it's clearer than ever that if they would have nuclear weapon, they would have used it against Israel and maybe also against Gulf states, and maybe they would intimidate Europe as well. They don't have still the range of United States, but they have the range with their longer range missiles. They can reach most European capitals. The first section or the first challenge was the killing of almost all the top military and defense commanders in Iran. We are speaking about 40 commanders, also some scientists that were working on the nuclear weapons, but the chief of staff, the deputy chief of staff, the commander of the Iranian Air Force, the commander of the Air Defense Corps, and so on and so forth, commander of the intelligence, and so on. And we did it twice, both in the Revolutionary Guard and the regular army. And this was the first phase or the first stage of the war. Of course, it took a long time to prepare, but it was less than 10 seconds to complete. In 10 seconds, in less than 10 seconds, all the 40 chief commanders of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard and the Iranian Standing Army were killed in Rising Lion. Now, many people are, the second stage was gaining air superiority over Iran. This took a day and a half, 36 hours, both operations, actually. The third and fourth phases were of course, destroying the nuclear industry and the defense industry, missile industry in general in Iraq, in Iran, sorry. And of course, the fourth phase was to defend ourselves against the Iranian reaction, against ballistic missiles, many hundreds of ballistic missiles and several thousands of explosive drones, long-range drones, and also cruise missiles that we had to defend ourselves. According to the media, approximately 200 Israeli aircrafts flew that night from Israel to Iran. 200. Most of them were not F-35. Most of them were regular F-15, F-16. Some of them were F-35. 200 aircrafts, this is a big armada of aircraft. They had to cross several countries in their way toward Iran. They have to cross either Syria and Jordan, then Iraq or Gulf states, and then you are reaching Iran. Iran is a very, very big state. Until Tehran, you have another 700 or 800 kilometers until you reach Tehran. The Iranians saw none. They saw nothing. They didn't notice 200 aircrafts that are moving towards them, that are entering their territory. Until the first explosions, they realized that their war had started only when they lost all the top military commanders and Revolutionary Guard commanders. So somehow, somebody managed to totally blind them that night. So this is an amazing achievement. It's an achievement of the Israeli Air Force, but also it's also a technological and scientific achievement. It was very important, by the way, to make it very short, because if instead of 10 seconds, it would take 10 minutes, then people would already go to bunkers or will escape themselves, will change their locations, and you couldn't get the same achievements. The second phase was reaching air superiority. In order to enable the Air Force for the next 11 days, or the next 40 days in the second round, to operate relatively freely above Iran and to really destroy all the massive military infrastructure and the defense industries of Iran, and of course, first and foremost, the most important, the nuclear facilities. It took a day and a half, 36 hours, until we gained air superiority over Tehran and over most of Iran. Just to give you the comparison, Russia, which is the second or third superpower in the world, which have an air force with that it is at least 10 times in its sizes, 10 times bigger than the Israeli Air Force. Big Russia is trying to gain air superiority over Ukraine and Kiev for almost 4 years now. And they are not there yet. And Kiev is only 120 kilometers from the border, not with Russia, from the border with Belarusia, with Belarusian. But Belarusia is part of the Russian military deployment. We achieved air superiority over Tehran in a day and a half, and Tehran is 1,500 kilometers from here. Still, again, you have to cross several other countries, and then another 800 or 900 kilometers above Iran in order to reach Tehran. Only several dozens infiltrated Israel and did hit the ground in Israel, several dozens out of 1,500, approximately 1,500. We managed to neutralize most of them, either with our very strong missile defenses, or in many cases, even when they were trying to launch them, we managed to intercept them, to destroy them before launching on the Iranian soil. Yeah, when they prepared them for launching, we managed to destroy many of them on the ground before. So we did suffer several hits, several dozens hits. It's very painful, but it was much less than anticipated. Some experts in Israel thought that we might have several thousand civilian casualties from the Iranian reaction. Any casualty is too much, but instead of several thousands, there were numerous casualties from those missiles in Israel. We see here a new kind of war. First, Israel and Iran in the first round. In the second round, it's also United States, of course, which is a real superpower. But let's speak about the first round. Israel and Iran actually are fighting each other from distance starting from 1,000 kilometers up to 3,000 kilometers. In the middle, you have several countries, Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Kuwait, Gulf states. The war, especially in Rising Lion, the war is above them. Yeah, the Iranians are shooting missiles and rockets and cruise missiles toward Israel. We are using mainly our air superiority in order to hit in Iran. We exchange fire for days and weeks above an entire region from very, very large distances. In the first round of Israel and United States, in the second round, vis-a-vis the Iranians. And by the way, the Iranians are very good in technology. They are very good, very talented people. They learn very fast. They did update and improve their systems during the war even. And of course, between the two rounds, they were running very fast to improve and to fix their systems. Luckily, we run even faster than them. And the end result is very, very clear. I don't know actually a better example of a crystal clear victory in modern war than this war between Israel and Iran in the first round and United States and Israel vis-a-vis Iran in the second round. First, we managed to really weaken the regime. Yes, the regime was not falling yet, and we don't know, and nobody can say with certainty if it will fall down and when. But clearly the regime was dramatically weakened. And the fact that you kill the top leadership once and again, and the top military leadership, and the top policing leadership once and again, if somebody thinks that this have no impact, I would say this is very strange. During October 2024, the Iranian managed to launch one barrage of 200 ballistic missiles toward Israel. Only few infiltrated, because we managed to shoot down most of them, but 200 ballistic missiles one day suddenly came from Iran in the same second, all of them were launched from Iran to Israel. Rising Lion, the biggest barrage was 50 missiles, and most of the barrages were 20 or 30 missiles together. This is important because if you send the barrages of hundreds of missiles or many dozens, it makes it difficult to the defense system to intercept all of them fast enough before they reach Israel. Yeah. So it's heavy burden. It's heavier burden on our missile defenses. So during Rising Lion, the biggest barrage was 50. During the last operation, the biggest barrage of missiles toward Israel was 8. There was one barrage of 8. Usually barrages were 3 or 4. In comparison to 200. So this is mainly because they suffer heavily in the command and control system, because they couldn't coordinate missiles from all over Iran to be launched together at exactly the same moment toward Israel. So if somebody thinks there is no impact here, this is ridiculous. They lost almost all of their airplanes, all of their air force. They lost almost all of their navy, maybe some boats left, but all the big and medium-sized ships, all of them were destroyed, mainly by the Americans this time, not by Israel. Israel contributed a little bit. All the defense industries were almost totally destroyed, which means that it will take them very long time, even if they will be able to invest billions of dollars, it will take them at least a few years to reestablish, to rebuild their missile production system, their missile industry, and of course their nuclear industry. Regarding the ballistic missiles, long-range ballistic missiles, okay, I'm speaking now from Israeli point of view, not from Qatar point of view or the Emirate point of view or Saudi Arabia. I'm speaking about missiles that can reach Israel and beyond, and also Europe, many of them. It's the beginning of Rising Lion. It was estimated that the Iranian possess 3,000 ballistic missiles that can reach Israel, approximately. Nothing is totally accurate. Approximately 3,000 ballistic missiles that can reach Israel with very heavy warheads. Today, it's my own estimate, I'm responsible to it, okay? I think they left with around 700 or 1,000 ballistic missiles that can reach Israel. Sometimes there is big confusion because also short-range missiles are actually ballistic missiles. Also ballistic missiles that can fly to 100 or 200 or 300 kilometers are also, in a sense, ballistic missiles. But we are speaking about the long-range, medium and long-range ballistic missiles. Ballistic missiles that can reach Israel and beyond. The plan to be able to produce every year 4,000, between 3,000 and 4,000 long-range ballistic missiles, this plan was eliminated. Because this time we destroyed not some bottlenecks, but all the industry. And now to the main issue, the nuclear issue. So the Iranian dealt with both efforts. They enriched uranium and they were trying to develop the mechanism that will enable to take this uranium and really to produce nuclear weapon. Because uranium alone is not nuclear weapon, even if it is highly, highly enriched. So what we did in those two operations. Speaking about uranium enrichment, we destroyed most of the enrichment sites. And actually, what have been left is 440 kilos of highly enriched uranium, 60%. 60% is almost 90%. It's very close. So we can say about enrichment, we destroyed most of it, we paralyzed most of it, but they are still pretty close, not far away. And now I estimate, it's my own estimation, that it will take them between 2 to 3 or 4 years to rebuild everything and to produce a real nuclear weapon. I would like to refer to the previous agreement, the JCPOA, to convince them how a good agreement should look like and what to insist about. And we had a very partial success. I want to go first to what was achieved in the JCPOA and what is missing that I hope that in case of a new agreement will be achieved now in order that it will be really good agreement. So first for the main two achievements. In the agreement in 2015, Iran actually gave up all the enriched material. Everything was delivered from Iran to Russia. Everything except 300 kilos of low enriched uranium of 3.5%. And they committed themselves within the agreement not to enrich uranium, again, with the exception that they can enrich uranium to 3.5%, but not to cross the 300 kilos. I didn't like the very fact that they still can enrich even to very low level and very little quantity, but they didn't give up the enrichment capabilities. They kept the enrichment, the centrifuges, most of the centrifuges, some of them were dismantled but not destroyed. Some of them were simply stopped working but standing where they were. The capability, the enrichment capabilities were still there. So this was a main fallacy, a main problem with the previous agreement. The second one, which is generally ignored, is that
according to the previous agreement, all the limitations on enrichment were only for 9 years. There were no limitation on the level of enrichment and also the quantity of enrichment, quantity and quality of enrichment after 11 years. So first, clearly, they have to give enrichment and the enriched materials. And then you have to add the dismantling of the enrichment capabilities. And of course, it cannot be only for 9 or 11 years. We hope the limitation will be forever, but at least for 20 years. This is the minimum that should be. And I want to add another factor that I think is very important. Everybody think about the ballistic missiles, but I think myself that it's very important to include a paragraph that they commit themselves also not to develop other kinds of weapon of mass destruction, chemical and biological weapon. The Egyptians were using chemical weapons against the Yemenites already in the 60s, in the 1960s. Then Saddam Hussein, another Arab country, Saddam Hussein was using chemical weapons against the Kurds. And then Assad, Bashar al-Assad, the Syrian regime, was using also chemical weapons in Syria during the civil war, yeah, mainly in Ruta near Damascus, with terrible consequences. So it's a dangerous area. And we already saw Arab and Muslim countries that are not only having those kinds of weapons, but are using them, by the way, until now, not against the Jews, not against Westerners, against other Arabs and Muslims, against Kurds, against Yemenites, against the Syrian civilians, not against us. So it's very important this time to fix the holes and the problems and the gaps in the previous agreement. And if we are going to have an agreement, it should be a much better agreement.
I'm glad that we got a chance to go through the top moments of these operations from someone who really knows what the Air Force did and what it took behind the scenes to get there. Thank you to Dr. Steinitz for making that speech and doing it in English so that all our listeners around the world could get something out of it. And now for a Torah thought by Rabbi Yossi Madvig of Oswego, New York.
This week we begin a brand new book of the Torah. That is the book of Bamidbar, which means in the desert. And it is always read before Shavuot, the holiday of the giving of the Torah. And at the end of the Haftorah, there's some very special verses where God says, I will betroth you to me forever. I will betroth you to me with righteousness and justice and with loving kindness and mercy. And then he concludes by saying, I will betroth you to me with faith, and you will know God. Now, betrothal in Judaism is the first legal stage of marriage. It's much more significant than what nowadays we call an engagement. It's a position where you're almost you're almost married, and if the relationship falls apart, you would actually, even at this stage, need a get, a divorce document. Now, God betrothed us to him by giving us the Torah. And by sharing it with us, he envelops us in this love and makes us completely his through his will, his wisdom, and his commandments. Unfortunately, by being in exile, we become less conscious of that relationship that we have with God. And normally, in ideal circumstances, just contemplating God's greatness as he's manifest in creation would be enough to sustain that love that we have for God, which we express through Torah study and prayer and fulfilling the commandments. But because we get so involved in the day-to-day and the physical aspects and the materiality of life, that dulls our spiritual sensitivity. So in that case, we have to not just contemplate God as he is in creation, but how God transcends everything, how he transcends this material world, and everything is insignificant compared to him. And by contemplating that deeply, we can hopefully cure our fascination with the world and all the distractions that are around us. And that will hopefully kindle that desire to be completely united with God. And when the Messiah comes, then we can for sure maintain that love continuously. And that's why God promises, I will betroth you forever. Now, there are some ways in which we can help reach this level. One is tzedakah, righteousness. Right? Money is sort of this idol, so to speak. It's this manifestation of, a physical manifestation of our connection to the material world. And by giving it freely to others through charity, through tzedakah, through righteousness, then we can break the hold that physicality has on us and focus on God. And that's why he says, I'll betroth you with tzedek, with righteousness. Second, we have a very strong ego. Now, that could help make sure that we have a healthy sense of ourself, and it could be a defense mechanism for spiritual growth and physical growth. But there is this evil that lies within us that is sometimes hard to overcome. And so in order to do that, we have to really think about how we are treating ourselves. You know, are we giving the spiritual side of ourselves the right amount of time? And third, we have to arouse mercy on our divine soul that's trapped in our physical body, in this physical world. And when we arouse that mercy, it'll hopefully motivate us to do everything we can to worship God, to pray, to learn Torah, to do his commandments. And we'll be able to fulfill them. And so God says, I will I'll betroth you with loving kindness and mercy. Right? These are the ideas of having mercy on the soul and doing the commandments. Now, it could be that it's hard for you to do one or all of these things. Maybe you don't have enough money. Maybe you don't have the spiritual fortitude to get rid of that internal evil. Or maybe you can't rouse those feelings of mercy for your divine soul. So in that situation, the intrinsic belief that we have in God, which can be fostered by contemplating his transcendence, as I said before, that can suffice to kindle that love for God. And that's why he says at the end, I will betroth you with faith. And like I said, the betrothal is just the first stage of marriage. And he concludes, therefore, you will know God, like Adam knew Eve. This is the same promise that God makes through the prophet Isaiah, when he says that the knowledge of God will fill the earth as the water covers the sea. And even though this promise will only be fulfilled ultimately when the Messiah comes, we can at least achieve a part of that, relatively speaking, since the Torah was given to us. So we can aspire even now, and that will hasten the fulfillment of the final redemption. May it be very soon in our days. Shabbat Shalom, and happy Shavuot. As we say, when the holiday of Shavuot is coming up, you should be mekabel the Torah, you should receive the Torah with joy and in an inward manner. It should permeate you. Shabbat Shalom.
All right, well, that is it for today's show. We gave you a little bit of everything. You got the security, you got the religious, you got the encouragement and the spiritual. Today is Thursday, May 14th, 2025. Happy Jerusalem Day. Tel Aviv has a low of 20 degrees Celsius and a high of 27 degrees. That's 68 degrees Fahrenheit for the low, going up to 81 degrees for the high. We are everywhere. Don't forget to sign up to our Israel Weekly News Wrap. The Israel Weekly News Wrap is a newsletter with the top five stories coming out of Israel from throughout the week. And of course, with a personal note from me at the top, you can sign up for that at israeldailynews.org. Scroll down to the bottom and drop your email address in. A big thank you goes out to our incredible sponsor, Marianne Vollinger, our writer, Perry Schwartz, and our associate producer, Lori May. Have a great and productive day and an excellent weekend. Shabbat Shalom, everyone.